This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The Women's Hoop Show, a podcast hosted by me, Jordan Robinson, brings you fresh women's basketball voices and breakdowns every week. I'll be joined by hoop experts all year long. Find the Women's Hoop Show on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
We originally wanted to have Alex Putterman on to talk about, he's got a bunch of stuff since then, but we wanted to talk about this relationship between the municipalities in Connecticut and the state right now over money and the budget. And there's a lot of tension. He's also written on Pura. He's written on housing. He's written on some stuff in education regarding restraints that I want to get to as well. But we welcome Alex back to the program here. Alex, good morning. How are you?
I'm good, Brian. How are you?
I'm good. So it looks like you've been kind of busy. You can go to ctinsider.com to read all of Alex's stuff. I was just honestly like, when there's a writer I want to talk to, I'll just Google the name and their organization, and then you go to their launch page where they have all their pieces. Now this you know, it's the town leaders are frustrated with Lamont over the budget, and I guess to move the conversation forward, two-parter, you know, one, are they justified, and two is like, Are we seeing property taxes go up in a lot of these towns?
Yeah, I mean, I think the tricky thing is that this time of year, a lot of different constituencies kind of are frustrated with the budget, and that's sort of part of the process. You know, they ask for more money, the governor says no, they ask for more money, the legislature maybe says yes, and, you know, it's kind of a touch-and-go negotiation. That said, I think the level of frustration from some of these town officials is sort of at the next level, to the point where they're calling out the governor by name, which isn't always the case. I think a lot of towns have seen property taxes go up. We all know that life has gotten more expensive, and that's the case for, you know, municipal budgets as well. And it's sort of the same story that you see in, you know, higher education or in nonprofits, where the costs are going up and people don't feel like the state is doing enough to pay for those costs. And so then, at least from the town leader perspective, if your costs are going up and you're not getting what you see as enough state money, you basically have two options. You either raise property taxes to pay for the stuff you want to pay for, or you start cutting stuff. And I think we've seen a little bit of both.
You know, normally, I do think there's the normal song and dance between the two, and this isn't necessarily in the piece, but I think the state's super worried about the unknown of the federal, you know, what kind of federal money might come down if Medicaid cuts and so on and so forth, and that's going to be potentially even more trouble for municipal budgets, because maybe some of that state money is not forthcoming if the state has to put their thumb in the dam of other spending spots.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. I've been thinking about that a lot as I'm covering state politics. And, you know, to some extent, things kind of feel like business as usual at the Capitol. But there's also this sort of Damocles hanging over the whole thing, where who knows what funding streams are going to be cut or go away and could sort of send everyone back to square one.
You know, we're talking to Alex Putterman from CT Insider here on Brian and Company. I might as well get, you know, since to make sure we can get it in, because we're always tight on time. The piece, you know, over the this, I don't know if it came out yesterday or last night about this. The headline is "Shocked by These Figures: Restraint and Seclusion Increased in Connecticut Schools Last Year." And I you have some great graphical elements too that shows that it's been up in like several consecutive years, but not necessarily at its highest levels, right? I mean, I think pre-pandemic it was even higher for 1 year back in 2019, but since basically 2020, 2021, it's been up every year, and it's more than double what it was 5 years ago. And the questions I have, a lot of people don't know, like, I had questions about where this happened. So, like, Is this in juvenile institutions? This is happening in you know, traditional elementary and middle schools in towns across the state. I mean, where is this happening?
Yeah. So for people who don't know, we're talking about when students are either physically restrained or locked in a secluded room for a period of time. And right. Yeah, it happens everywhere. You know, this data is focused on schools specifically, and you know, it's roughly more or less half and half between public schools and like special education schools, which tend to have more incidents. They say they're dealing with the most difficult kids. But you know, a lot of advocates and parents. So we've been reporting on restraint and seclusion pretty closely for several years now, and I have just heard from so many parents who have, you know, similar stories of their kids being, you know, held down or locked away, and the damage it does to them when they come home. And in some cases, they don't feel like the schools are communicative enough about it. And, you know, I've had parents break down crying to me on the phone or in person about this stuff. You know, it can be really scary. And then, you know, on the other side, the schools and the teachers sometimes say, well, you know, sometimes it's necessary if a kid is really riled up and is sort of unsafe in the classroom, a risk to others, then it might become necessary. You know, the question is it happening there were 40,000 restraint and seclusion instances across Connecticut schools in the 2023-24 school year. So the question is, are we to believe that there were 40,000 incidents where a kid was such a threat to themselves or others that they needed to be physically held down by a much larger adult? You know, I don't know. A lot of people would say that's hard to believe. So, you know, it's a thorny issue. There's been talk about legislation to do something about it. It hasn't really happened, but it's definitely something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. It's like, is behavior worse, or is how we deal with them worse, or is it speak to the pressure in the classroom? I mean, that is such an essential question. And I mean, I just think of myself when I was in school. I mean, all my time in public school, which was through the 10th grade, I never saw anyone on faculty and staff put their hands on a student, maybe except for gym class, like pulling somebody by the ear, you know what I mean? So, it's definitely, you know, something I don't have a lot of experience with. Alex Putterman from CT Insider, you know, we talk a ton about housing on the show, and, you know, you wrote about something that I think is, you know, sort of in many ways self-evident. I mean, we just don't have affordable housing. You know, there's a huge shortage everywhere. And I guess the question I have is, and I even talked about it with Jill Schlesinger earlier this morning, there's a lot of, like, not in my backyard here in Connecticut. And my question is in your reporting, is there a lot coming online, or is this something where stuff isn't even in the pipeline?
I live in West Hartford, not far away from several new or under construction, pretty big housing development. So it's not like there's, you know, no housing, but I think when you look at the data and when you talk to people, housing is not being built fast enough to deal with, you know, I think we've all probably experienced it. You know, if you're a homeowner, maybe it's good news. Your property value is going up because no one can find housing. If you're a renter like I am, it's bad news because, you know, it's hard to find housing that you can afford. So I think the consensus is kind of that not enough housing is being built quickly enough, or the right kinds of housing. You know, there are all sorts of debates there. And then the debate just becomes, you know, what kind of housing and where to put it. And as you well know, Brian, you know, people have strong opinions about that question.
Yeah, it's difficult. And I mean, again, the concept of affordable housing now is totally different, because you could have a family with dual income and everything's, you know, seems to be robust, and they still can't afford to live. You know what I mean? And so the whole concept of affordable housing is shifting too. It's not just like, you know, some intensely, you know, on the poverty line type situation. We're talking families that are, you know, have family budgets that are decent that still can't afford housing here in Connecticut. Again, you can read all Alex's stuff at ctinsider.com. Alex, thanks for the time. We appreciate it as always.
Anytime, Brian. Thanks.